Good afternoon. This is Sasha inviting you to stay tuned after the news for a discussion on the confirmation hearings of Judge Sonia Sotomayor. Judge Sotomayor was already twice confirmed by the Senate. Will she be confirmed for the third time as Supreme Court Justice? And what will the hearing reveal about her qualifications and judicial temperament that the Senate committee didn't already know? Analyzing the confirmation process, my guest is Mark Levine, a former congressional attorney serving on the Judicial Committee. Mr. Levine currently hosts the Inside Scoop, a political talk radio and television show originating from Washington, D.C. Please stay tuned and call us with your questions and comments. Good afternoon. This is Sasha, and you are listening to Sound Off with Sasha, where we discuss current topics and events with knowledgeable guests and invite your questions and comments. Our telephone number is 877-GCU-TALK, and I shall repeat the number later on in the conversation. Feel free to disagree with anything you hear. Judge Sonia Sotomayor has already gone through and passed two former confirmation hearings conducted by the Senate, so her third confirmation hearing for the Office of Supreme Court Justice was watched with curious anticipation, wondering what it would reveal that the Senate Judiciary Committee didn't already know. Despite the assumed familiarity of the senators with Sotomayor's position, they repeatedly ask her about guns, abortion, and whether she will be able to judge respecting the Constitution and following the law. Still concerned that Sotomayor would bring bias and political agenda to the bench, Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama was quoted to say about her testimony, "I frankly am a bit disappointed in the lack of clarity and consistency in her answers. It's muddled, confusing, backtracking on issue after issue." Yet, according to the general consensus expressed by observers, Judge Sotomayor will be confirmed. So why the elaborate questioning and grilling? Was this a rehearsal in preparation for President Obama's future Supreme Court nominees? Commenting on the procedure, the questioning, and Judge Sotomayor's testimony, my guest is former congressional attorney Mark Levine, who served on the House Judiciary and Homeland Security Committees. He currently hosts Radio Inside Scoop, a political talk radio and television show originating from the Washington, D.C. area, and available on the internet at Radio Inside Scoop, it's one word, radioinsidescoop.com. Do join us with your questions and comments by calling 877-GCU-TALK. And I now welcome Mark Levine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sasha, for having me.
Well, I wanted to ask you, in your capacity as a former congressional attorney, are there any established rules for conducting confirmation hearings, such as the length and depth of the interrogation?
There really are no rules at all, according to the Constitution, which simply says that the Senate should advise and consent on judicial nominees. Now, what does that mean? Well, it's clear that the Senate gets a vote, but exactly how the Senate advises and consents is something that the Senate itself disagrees with. Since pretty much Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg and pretty much since then, most nominees have done their best to avoid answers to difficult questions. And I think Judge Sotomayor is no different from Alito and Roberts and Ginsburg and Breyer in that regard. They seem to understand that if they announce their position one way or the other on abortion or guns or something like that, that will alienate half the Senate. So they say, well, this is an issue that's going to come before me and I won't decide it. And at least for the last 20 years, senators have accepted that. But they don't have to. The Constitution certainly does not require them to do that. And a Senate could say, well, we're not going to vote on you unless you answer these questions. But the Senate has not been that strong with any nominee in the past 20 years.
Now, I was asking this because, as I mentioned before, Judge Sotomayor had gone through this procedure twice before. And wouldn't the Senate already know her guiding judicial principles? And if so, who is really being addressed with these questions?
Well, I mean, obviously, she's been on the bench more than a decade since her last acceptance. She was nominated to the district court by George H.W. Bush. She was nominated to the appellate court by Bill Clinton. That was more than 10 years ago. I think that anyone would say that the best way to evaluate a judge is not so much by what she or he says at confirmation hearings, but by what she or he has written over the course of a career. And Judge Sotomayor has a longer judicial record than any sitting nominee on the United States Supreme Court. She's been on the bench for 16 years, and really it's hard to find anything in her record that's that extreme. That's why the Republicans are focusing mostly on her speeches rather than her judicial record.
Now, most observers quietly agree that she was going to be confirmed. In that case, do the senators adjust their style of questioning?
Well, I think most observers loudly say she's going to be confirmed.
Yes.
I mean, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina on day one, before Judge Sotomayor had even spoken, said that unless you have an extreme meltdown, which no one thinks you're going to have, you're going to be confirmed. The Democrats, of course, have 60 members. Even if the Republicans were to mount a filibuster, and there's a long history there on why they would not do that, she could still be confirmed, and she's not seen as some radical leftist judge. So I think everyone in the Senate was really speaking to their audience, speaking to their constituents, trying to speak to people back home, whether it's in Alabama and Texas or in Vermont or New York, much more than they really were seeking to get anything from Judge Sotomayor.
Well, yes, one school of thought was that it served as a dress rehearsal for Republican senators for any future nominees.
I think that's true. I think the feeling is that if they don't hit her hard now, that Obama might appoint someone more liberal than she, and therefore this is very much a dress rehearsal.
Now, a Republican consultant, Rich Galen, called the hearings a kabuki dance, the highly stylized Japanese play where the outcome is well known beforehand. But in this case, was this the purpose then? In other words, to send messages to your constituents or to your donors or whoever?
I think it was a kabuki dance. I largely agree with him. This is not a case where we have a woman who is not well known. Again, if she were new to the bench, Sandra Day O'Connor, for example, was a state legislator, did not have this kind of history that Judge Sotomayor had. And for her, her views really were unknown, and people were seeking to explore them. As I said, even though Judge Sotomayor didn't say much at the hearings about her views, she has a very, very long judicial record. And that's really how, if anyone wants to know how she's going to vote, that's the best way to evaluate her.
Well, I hear some people still questioning her qualifications, and which really surprises me because I don't know how that works, but I keep reading that you don't even have to be a judge to become a Supreme Court.
You certainly don't. One of the most famous chief justices in American history, Chief Justice Earl Warren, was a former governor of California, appointed by Republican President Dwight Eisenhower, and of course was the famous Chief Justice during the Brown versus Board of Education decision. You do not, as I said. Senator Day O'Connor was a state legislator. In recent years, though, most everyone appointed has been a judge. And her qualifications, the American Bar Association voted unanimously. Every single member voted to give her the highest qualifications. As I said, she had more judicial experience than any sitting member on the bench. You can disagree with some of her speeches, and many Republicans do, but it's very hard to discount her qualifications.
Now, who were the main opponents of Sotomayor's confirmation?
I would think that Jeff Sessions, Senator of Alabama, would be one of the ones leading the charge. And he has his own history, of course. He was a judge, and he was rejected by the Senate when he was appointed by, I believe it was Ronald Reagan, to the bench. May have been George W. Bush. He was appointed by a Republican president. He was rejected by the Senate because he is someone who said things such as the NAACP is un-American, made jokes about the KKK. This is obviously the senator from Alabama. He said it was just a joke, but for that reason, he wasn't put on the court. So he has his own sort of row to hoe, as it were. He has his own motivations, and I think he, in focusing on Judge Sotomayor's famous wise Latina woman comment, showed where he was coming from.
Now, And again, of the other people, not necessarily Sessions, but what would have been the general nature of their objection to her confirmation?
Well, again, I think most of the objection comes from her speeches, and not from her rulings, although there is the infamous New Haven firefighters case, the Ritchie case.
Yes, I want to talk about that.
We can talk. That's one ruling that people do criticize. Other than that, I haven't heard many critics of her rulings. They're mostly criticizing her speech, which I would actually invite anyone to read. I, in fact, just read it again prior to going on this interview. It's on the New York Times, where you read her full speech. And what Judge Sotomayor is saying in that speech is that people have their natural biases, that they may not want to admit them, but people have different life experiences that cause them to see things in different ways. This, I think, is unexceptional. I think most people realize that different people have life experiences that are different, and that's where she says that she would hope that a wise Latino woman with a richness of experience could rule better than a white man. But what she was saying in that, and she admitted her rhetorical flourish fell flat, what she was suggesting is that in the context of a speech where she's noting that the great weight of judges are white males, and that there are very few women and Latinos on the court, she was saying that this is why we need a diversity of people on the court, because different people bring different experiences to the bench. And she fully admits in that speech that obviously it was nine white men that gave the decision in Brown versus Board of Education. So it's not that a white man can't rule wisely, but she was noting how the diversity experience helps.
But there is also the question that was brought up that everybody is asking or criticizing her, maybe pointing out her ethnicity and her gender. But has anybody really pushed and gone after a white man, challenging whether his white maleness has anything to do with his judgment?
I think you only need to compare her to the last nominee to the Supreme Court, Justice Alito, who talked about how his Italian heritage and a child of immigrants affected his upbringing and how his experiences affect his view. And no one seems to have challenged that his Italian immigrant upbringing was somehow a problem in affecting his view. He said it quite openly, and it wasn't really challenged. It is interesting that really a very similar view, only from a Latino woman, I mean, she's, again, child of immigrants, in fact, immigrants from Puerto Rico, which, of course, is part of the United States, and yet her saying that her experiences affect her views achieved much more criticism.
I think we talked about that op-ed piece by David Brooks when he was talking about that yes, indeed. If you look at a case of a 14-year-old girl being strip searched, a woman justice may be able to consider the invasion of her privacy, but a male judge may look at it from the point of view that it was necessary for security.
I think that's possible. Look, again, one of the things that Judge Sotomayor made clear in that speech, and I really would encourage your listeners to read the entire speech, is that it doesn't have to be that way, that you certainly cannot say that because it's a man or because it's a woman that a judge will, you know, therefore rule a certain way. Many scholars note that, of course, Justice Clarence Thomas does not hold views of more than 90% of African Americans in the United States. But her point at writ large still holds. I mean, she cites statistics showing that, for example, there has never, ever been a United States Supreme Court finding in favor of a woman for being discriminated against until 1972.
Really?
And that women judges, on average, again, on the statistics, are more likely to find for a woman who claims to be discriminated against than a man is. And you can say that's just, you know, noise or statistics, but it does bear out. I think the difference between Judge Sotomayor and her critics is that her critics pretend that justice is always colorblind, and Judge Sotomayor recognizes that it isn't, and yet tries very hard to distinguish her prejudices by recognizing them, whereas her critics would suggest that there are no prejudices.
But if a justice has a different point of view, isn't it more like being in a room with the jury where people just put in their views and see how it sounds and then maybe they just dish it out? So whatever her view is not necessarily the final word.
Well, obviously, there are 9 members of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. So her input is valuable. It's not going to be necessarily the result.
And frankly, given that she's replacing Judge Souter, who was seen as on the lefter side of the court, that probably won't change much either. I think what Judge Sotomayor is saying basically is that she has fidelity to the law. That is her first goal. I think that's the first goal of the great majority of people on the bench. But there are times when your personal experience helps you understand what's going on in real life, and she doesn't plan to run from what she knows from her personal experience.
Now, this is interesting because there was much to be made of the empathy factor. And I'm reading a quote from a review, and it says, they succeeded in getting Sotomayor to distance herself from Obama's wish for justices who have empathy and his belief that what is in a judge's heart could influence rulings. And apparently her distancing herself is claimed as a victory.
You know, I guess I think it's two sides of the same coin. I think that Judge Sotomayor emphasized her fidelity to the law. I think all judges do that, and all judges should do that. And I do think that judges, most of them, try as hard as they can to look at the law and apply it. Now, we do have a fairly activist Supreme Court right now. You have the 5 members who are seen as the right edge of the court being far more judicially activist than those on the left side. They're the ones overturning congressional laws far more than the ones who believe more in judicial restraint.
All right, let me stop you here because I think this is important what you said. And would you just repeat it or elaborate on that?
Certainly. Basically, there are sort of 2 different ways of looking at judicial rulings. One is to show great deference to the elected lawmakers, people like Congress, and to say the people elected them, they should generally get their way.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is, and that would be more judicial restraint. And that's shown by the more, what people call liberal justices, Ginsburg and Breyer and, well, it was Souter, he's no longer there, and Justice John Paul Stevens. They tend to uphold congressional laws. And then you have the Scalia's, Rehnquist, well, not Rehnquist anymore, excuse me, Scalia, Roberts, Alito, Thomas. They are the ones that are much more likely to try to overturn precedent. And they've been overturning precedents very strongly. Yeah, all you have to do is look at statistics, and you can see that the people who are more likely to change prior precedent are those on the conservative end. Now, you can argue they're doing the right thing because that's the Constitution and that's what they're supposed to do, but they are more likely to challenge the elected representatives than, say, the liberal side of the court.
Well, you brought up an interesting question, and I always wanted to ask that. What happens, let's say, just a hypothetical, that the Congress would come up with an insane law? And what can the judges do about it? I mean, in other words, do they have to accept it?
Well, it all depends on whether it's unconstitutional or not. The general rule is, and I tend to be a strict constructionist myself, the general rule is that if Congress passes a law, unless it violates the Constitution, that's the law, and they must accept it. Now, courts sometimes go through hoops to when Congress passes, as you say, a crazy law, to say, well, Congress could never have meant this because that makes no sense at all. They must have meant that.
Uh-huh.
And courts all the time interpret ambiguous legislative pronouncements. And if the court gets it wrong, if the court says Congress meant A, Congress can always vote again and say, no, we really meant B. And when that happens, the court has to back down. But unless something is unconstitutional, a court is supposed to uphold the elected representatives, whether it be in Congress or, frankly, a state legislature, unless it violates the Constitution.
All right. I'm speaking with Mark Levine, who was a former congressional attorney, and he has a radio show, a radio and television show called The Inside Scoop, generating from Washington. And you can give us a call and talk to him at 877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. And, here we go. We go to Larry from Marco Island. Good afternoon, Larry. Go ahead, please.
Hello.
Hi.
Sasha, I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
But I have a question. I listened to Mark Levine, and I was wondering, is he the same Mark Levine that wrote the article about the FBI cover-up up north in Tampa?
Yes, that was me.
Oh.
All right. Are those people that covered up the meeting between the white supremacists and and the Islamist supremacists still in charge of the Tampa office, which is in charge of us?
My understanding, Larry, is that's exactly the case. The Tampa FBI, for those that don't know, this was a front-page article. I do investigative reporting, and this was the headline article on Alternet. And it has to do with an FBI cover-up of a meeting between white supremacists and Islamic terrorists. Basically, the FBI had illegally recorded part of the conversation, and rather than excise that portion and continue to investigate the terrorists, they decided to cover it up to protect their own jobs and to basically let the terrorists go because they were afraid that they might get in trouble. So the Tampa office of the FBI, this was explored. It went all the way up there was an inspector general's report, and no one was fired, and apparently everyone's still there. The people who broke the law, who forged the documents in Tampa, the people who decided that American security was less important than their own jobs, they're still working there. However, the agent that exposed their cover-up, unfortunately, no longer is working there, and this is a guy who worked undercover and protected American lives, actually pretended to join racist groups and protected against the bombing of a black church, even, for 16 years. He's gone, but the bad guys are still there, yes, in Tampa.
What about the plot to kill the journalists and to kill the Jews?
Well, the white supremacists and Islamic terrorists, according to the Inspector General's report, are not being investigated. According to Tampa, despite the fact that there's a transcript of the meeting, they never met. And even if they did meet, they didn't talk about terrorism. And even if they met and talked about terrorism, there's no transcript. But, of course, we know there is a transcript, and they did talk about terrorism, and Senator Chuck Grassley has confirmed all of that.
Well, Larry, I really appreciate your call, and I'm surprised that you have already read it and know about the article. Thank you for your call. Maybe you could, Mark, you could mention the title and where the article is available.
Certainly. The title is Why the FBI Squelched an Investigation into a meeting between white supremacists and Islamic terrorists, something like that. I don't have the exact title in front of me. It was on the front page of alternet.org last Thursday, a week ago Thursday. You can find it there, or there's a link to it on my website at radioinsidescoop.com.
All right. And as this gentleman mentioned, was there a conclusion to this case?
Well, the conclusion, unfortunately, is that the Tampa FBI is stonewalled. The Justice Department's Inspector General issued an official report finding that the Tampa FBI lied to investigators, forged documents, and ended a terrorist investigation that should not have been ended. In other words, there are these terrorists plotting to kill Americans that Tampa FBI chose not to go against. But they said they could not determine who in Tampa did this, and therefore no one would be disciplined.
Well, this is an unusual, strange combination of people with a common goal. Apparently, who were exactly these people?
They were leaders.
The white supremacists and...
Right. And an Islamic extremist group. And they met, and some people may be surprised to know that these groups would work together. After all, white supremacists don't usually like to work with brown-skinned people. But apparently, when they have a common goal, they were willing to work together, and the Islamic extremists had gotten arms from Iran. They talked about how they approved of suicide bombings, their affection for Hitler, and that they could go around and shoot Jews and shoot journalists and foment civil war in the United States. This is all, by the way, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley has issued a report about this. It hasn't gotten much press, which is one of the reasons why I did my investigative report on it, particularly as the corruption appears to go up to the director of the FBI, Robert Mueller, which makes the whole thing very scary. And again, there's more information. There's a very long, detailed article on my website that if people are interested, they should review.
Yes. All right. We have another call. This is Suzanne from Fort Myers. Good afternoon, Suzanne. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Sasha.
Hi.
You know, I did read that article online of Mr. Levine's, and I was really horrified by it. But it just seems so implausible that the FBI would go to all this trouble just to sort of cover their tracks. I mean, it almost seems like maybe somebody in the Tampa office is in cahoots with the Klan. And I just wondered what Mark Levine thinks about that.
All right. Thank you for your question. And please listen on your radio for the response. Thank you, Suzanne.
Thank you, Suzanne. That wasn't my impression, or at least that hasn't been proved. Obviously, I can't know what's in everyone's hearts and minds. But if you read the details of the article, and particularly if you read the far more lengthy Inspector General's report, it appears that Tampa really wasn't racist. They were concerned about protecting illegal methods. When Agent German, in fact, challenged Tampa about some illegal recordings they did, they said, let's just pretend it didn't happen. And then Agent German said, well, we can't do that. It's against the law. It's a criminal violation. And heck, people will find out anyway, so it doesn't make sense to do it. And then they said, okay, there was no meeting. So I don't think it's because the people in the Tampa office, whoever did this, was racist or trying to protect the terrorists. I think they were trying to protect their jobs and, frankly, weren't concerned about the fact that all American lives could be in danger. But really, I think it's more CYA, as it were, than actual racism. But that doesn't make it less horrifying, to use the word that Suzanne used. I think it is horrifying that people would protect their jobs rather than protect American lives. And obviously, all they had to do in the first place was to say, okay, we'll just get rid of this little illegal recording and we'll do the rest legally. And that's done all the time. It was the fact that they wanted to do the illegal surveillance that caused really the rupture in the FBI.
Well, since we're talking about this, I really don't understand how, Homeland Security and all those people didn't get involved and wanted to pursue this.
Well, I don't understand it either. Agent German didn't understand it either. Senator Chuck Grassley doesn't understand it either. And the thing about this issue, obviously, it's not a Democratic or Republican issue. It's an American security issue. And as Agent German reports, when he raised it to the director, because before he went public, he went all the way up through internal channels, even going to Director Mueller, the head of the FBI, who's still, by the way, the director of the FBI under Obama. He was originally appointed by Bush. It was only after going directly to Director Mueller's office that the office then challenged Agent German on a $50 expense that apparently was a proper expense, but that he used in Tampa. And so, in other words, they took him off the investigation because he raised too many questions. I think it's very similar to the thin blue line that unfortunately infects some police. That doesn't mean that most police, I think most FBI agents and most police are just trying to do their job. But there is this idea that you protect yourself and you protect your colleagues even when it means ruining an investigation. And that's something that I would like to see rooted out of the FBI, and I hope this article brings it to people's attention. I know that's certainly Senator Grassley's wish as well.
Well, is it possible that even though they didn't want to go into the previous undercover investigation, that and they covered it up or whatever, but that they are indeed perhaps monitoring the people in question?
It's possible, but I think it's unlikely. And the reason I think it's unlikely is because Agent Michael German was in charge of the investigation. And this is a man who, as I said, went undercover in white supremacist organizations for 16 years. And they took him off the investigation. And as I said, they told their people, not Senator Grassley, they told the FBI and the Justice Department there was no meeting. And even if there was a meeting, they didn't talk about terrorism. And even if they did, there was no tape. Three inconsistent things. So they're telling their higher-ups that there's nothing going on. Now, perhaps 8 years after the fact, perhaps after the Inspector General's report, they are now quietly reinvestigating these people. I hope they are. If they haven't been, maybe this article will get them to do so. But we know that at least for a period of 5 years, they certainly were not.
All right. Our telephone number is 877-GCU-TALK, and we are talking with Mark Levine, who is a former congressional attorney and who now has a radio talk show, a radio and television talk show called The Inside Scoop, originating from the Washington area. And we were talking about originally about Judge Sotomayor's confirmation and other stuff. So you are welcome to call us with your questions and comments. And here we have another Larry. It's a day for Larry's. Good afternoon, Larry from Englewood.
Hi, Sasha.
Hello.
You got a very interesting guest there.
Yes, he is.
Yes. Why is it that the ACLU hasn't pressed this matter further?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think Mark has the answer for that. Thank you for calling, and listen to the response on your radio. All right? Thanks.
Well, I assume you mean the FBI matter, not Judge Sotomayor.
Oh, no, yes, of course.
And actually, Agent Mike German now works for the ACLU. Again, he spent 16 years in the FBI, and when they took him off of all these covert investigations, he now works for the ACLU. They have asked, they have pushed far more powerful people than the ACLU has pushed. I mean, Senator Chuck Grassley is a very powerful and respected Republican senator, and he has pushed. He, in fact, demanded the transcript that the FBI said didn't exist, and then 2 years later they sheepishly gave him the transcript that they said didn't exist. And so I think the ACLU has been pushing, but I think, as I said, Senator Grassley has been pushing. I heard the Director Mueller, who appears before Senator Grassley's committee once a year for an oversight hearing, and I've heard Senator Grassley twice ask him these questions, and both times Director Mueller said, I'll have to get back to you. And then he waited an entire year, asked the same questions. Clearly Mueller had not gotten back to him. I think it's a clear case of stonewalling, and they're embarrassed by what their agents did. And maybe they don't know who did it in Tampa, but I don't think they seem to be very concerned about finding out.
Well, what exactly would the ACLU interest would be in this case?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think the illegal recording would probably be their interest.
Yeah, but
I think we all have an interest, frankly, in protecting against terrorist attacks on Americans.
Yeah.
I think that's something that, whatever your political persuasion, you should support. But in essence, the reason why the problem happened is that Agent German is a straight arrow and insisted everything go by the book. And, obviously the people in Tampa didn't want to do that.
Well, it's really. Do you think that there would be some kind of a follow up or a conclusion to this story?
I don't know. I think it depends on the public. I actually think it depends. I'm glad that we had three callers who've read the article. So obviously, it's achieved some critical mass. I think if people were to write their members of Congress and say, "Hey, help Chuck Grassley out," why is the FBI doing this? If you read the article, you see that it's a systemic problem. This isn't a matter of a few agents in Tampa, but the fact that they were covered up for by their bosses and their bosses' bosses, all the way up to the director. And, of course, the FBI has a history of lawlessness. We all know that J. Edgar Hoover illegally recorded Martin Luther King. The rule in law is that you have to have some suspicion that a crime is being committed, and then you go and you get a warrant, and then you record someone. So they could certainly record these proto-terrorists. But the FBI apparently is recording a lot more than that, and they're recording innocent conversations when they really should be going after these terrorist groups.
All right. So in closing on this story, I understand that Agent German is in the process of writing a book.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. And the title is in my article. I think it's something like Fighting Terrorism. I don't have it in front of me.
All right.
But he's a very, I tell you, if people want to find out more about this, on my website, I have a full one-hour interview with Agent German. I have, including just a two-minute clip there where you can hear the part where he goes to the director of the FBI. And I've got to say, he's one of my personal heroes. I mean, someone who really tried to work on the inside and deal with it, going through all the proper steps. And only when he was absolutely stymied did he go public and he did the right thing. He went to Congress. And it always sickens me, I guess, when I see an American trying to do the right thing, trying to follow the law and protect us from terrorism, and he is kicked out of the system while a bunch of corrupt people who don't care about American security are in the system. I have a real problem with that, and I would think most people, whatever your political persuasion, would have a problem with that.
Yes. All right. Now, let's go back to Sotomayor.
Sure, please.
Yes, we were talking about some of the definitions. For instance, you mentioned about activist judge. And she was at one point accused of being an activist judge. Is that does she qualify for that?
You know, I don't hear that much criticism of that, of her today. Even the decision that she's been most criticized for, the Ritchie decision, the one of about the New Haven firefighters, in that case, she upheld existing law. And then the United States Supreme Court overturned her decision and overturned existing law. So if activism is the problem, then you could complain the Supreme Court is the problem. These words are sometimes thrown around basically to say that if you rule the way I don't like, you're an activist.
Yeah.
and you find both liberals and conservatives doing that. When liberals uphold certain civil rights for certain minorities, conservatives call them activists. And when conservatives uphold rights for corporations over individuals, liberals call them activists. Really, I think the only proper definition of an activist judge is whether they're not overturning the rules of elected representatives or overturning prior precedent. And sometimes that's the right thing to do. I mean, Brown versus Board of Education, you could argue, was activist. It overturned 60 years of precedent, beginning with Plessy v. Ferguson, that separate but equal was okay. So there is a time for judicial activism, but I think most legal scholars would say that it is something that should be used sparingly and only when the injustice is clear.
Now, the case about the firefighters, this was a case waiting to be heard by the Supreme Court, and some people suggested that the her confirmation was basically postponed to hear the outcome of the Supreme Court decision. Well, we know how it turned out, but what significance does it have on her confirmation?
I don't think it has much significance. It is an interesting case. It goes back to some deep-rooted precedents that have been overturned by the Supreme Court, and people are all over the map on this. The test that New Haven gave to its firefighters, one could argue, is not the proper test for firefighters. For example, they asked whether words were misspelled. One could argue that whether or not you have someone who's willing to climb up a ladder, has the strength to you know, bring a person down it, save lives, and fight fires, it does not depend on whether or not they can spell certain words correctly.
Well, show me any CBO and ask me how do they spell.
Well, you know, if it were a lawyer, I would think spelling would be proper. I would not want to hire as a lawyer in my law firm someone who can't spell. But as a firefighter, I think it's perhaps a different kind of test. And we know that this test did lead to whites and one Latino doing better than the African Americans. I don't know what that says about our education system in this country, but the point is that New Haven feared, based on prior precedent, that a test that discriminated on the basis of race and didn't have as much direct correlation with what a firefighter is required to do, that they could be sued. And so they changed the test to do a more firefighter-specific test, at which point the white firefighter sued. So poor New Haven, they were damned if they did and damned if they didn't.
So eventually, I really wanted to ask you to explain the difference between a lower court and the Supreme Court. In other words, if the Sotomayor or her panel's decision was based on precedent, that's what they're supposed to do in the lower court, right?
That's what they're required to do.
Yes, and then it is up to the Supreme Court to create new precedent.
Right, and usually when they do it, they claim that they're not doing it. It's one of those sort of things that you learn as a lawyer. Lower courts and appellate courts have far less leeway than the United States Supreme Court. If there's a direct U.S. Supreme Court hearing on a case on something, they've got to follow that precedent. Of course, new laws are created all the time, ambiguous situations are created all the time, so lower courts do have a chance to give legal rulings, but they can always be overturned by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's adherence to precedent is not as strong, shall we say. There is this doctrine called stare decisis, and basically that means already decided.
What is it called?
Stare, S-T-A-R-E, Decisis, D-E-C-I-S-I-S. It's Latin. It's one of the reasons people pay lawyers, so we can learn these Latin terms.
And I am glad that you can spell, yes.
Yeah, and I can spell, but maybe I'm not a good firefighter.
I'm sure you aren't.
But in any case, the doctrine of stare decisis says that when the Supreme Court has a settled precedent, when they've ruled one way for a long time, that they should refrain from willy-nilly changing that decision, because the law depends on a certain amount of certainty. And if the Supreme Court rules one way and then 3 years later rules the other way and then 3 years later rules the other way, that could cause a lot of havoc in the system. And so one of the things, for example, that Judge Sotomayor said was that the abortion laws were settled precedent. But any precedent can be overturned by the United States Supreme Court. As I said, Plessy v. Ferguson, the separate but equal case that allowed Jim Crow laws and discrimination against African Americans, was settled precedent for 60 years. And yet the Supreme Court, I think, did the right thing in Brown v. Board of Education and overturning that settled precedent. Many people think that the United States Supreme Court should overturn Roe v. Wade and end the right of American women to have abortions. So settled precedent can be overturned. But the doctrine of stare decisis says that if you're going to do so, you should do so rarely and cautiously.
Yes, Now, there were some interesting questions which really required an insight into the law. But she was asked or challenged about a statement she made on the uncertainty of the law. And she was asked why, in any case, the law could be uncertain.
Well, and I think that the law is often uncertain. I mean, after all, that is what a judge is required to do. That's why they pay her the big bucks, right? I mean, it is her job.
Do they get big bucks?
Well, not as much as a corporate attorney.
Yes.
Certainly. They make about $150,000 a year, something like that. No, I think that is the role of a judge, particularly an appellate court judge. Now, a lower court judge may decide certain facts, certain evidentiary rulings, particular to a case. But as she once said and was criticized for saying, a lot of policy is made at the appellate court level, meaning that if there's an ambiguity in how a law is to be read, it is up to usually the appellate courts first to determine, oh, well, Congress meant that or Congress meant this.
Yes.
And that's so I think it is fantasy to believe that there's never uncertainty in the law, just like I think it's fantasy to believe that a wise old man, a wise old woman, or frankly, any two wise people should necessarily come to the same conclusion. There are difficult questions in the law, and perhaps 95% of the time the law is clear, but it's the 5% of the time when the law is unclear that we really learn who judges are and how their rulings matter.
Now, she was also questioned, I just noticed this almost in the same vein, she was also questioned about the word, she was asked, why do you think indefiniteness is important to the law? And her answer to that was, if law was always clear, we wouldn't have judges. It is because there is indefiniteness, not in what the law is, but its application to new facts.
And I think that's the point I was trying to make.
Yes, I know. That's why I saw this other reference that fit there. Now, what do you think they wanted to basically, I don't want to use the word pin her down, but they wanted her to commit to certain things, such as her statement on guns. What were they trying to do?
Well, I think this is part of the kabuki dance that you mentioned at the beginning of the interview. It is always the senator's job to try to get an answer for their constituents. How would you rule on these things that my constituents care about? And abortion and guns are usually the two biggest issues, although there are others. And on guns, they wanted her to say whether or not she believed in an individual right under the Second Amendment. Now, this is something that's been hotly debated for centuries. And the Supreme Court just ruled, really overturning prior precedent and a judicially activist ruling, determined that there is an individual right under the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment to the United States Constitution says, and I don't have it in front of me, but I can pretty much quote it, it says that the right of a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to bear arms shall not be infringed. That's,
you know, I once read a whole study, and apparently very studious people and experts decided that the Second Amendment is the most loosely worded and misinterpreted one.
Well, it's the only amendment that has a preamble. Right? It doesn't say that because of this, that, or the other, we get free speech or we get freedom of religion. It has a preamble, and many legal scholars said that because of that preamble, it protects a militia and doesn't protect an individual rights. Other scholars say, ignore the preamble. What it says is the right of the people to bear arms shall not be infringed. So it has this inherent contradiction within it. And the Supreme Court has held that there is an individual right, but it can be regulated, which suggests to me, I'm not so sure there's an individual right. If you can regulate it out of existence, then, but they say there's a point where it can't go too far. So now the question is, okay, what regulations are fair, what's not fair, and like all amendments to the Constitution, there's wiggle room.
So you are saying that just recently it was made to be an individual right?
Yes, in District of Columbia versus Heller, the District of Columbia passed a law banning most handguns, allowing rifles, but they had to be disabled. It's one of the strictest gun laws in the country. And the U.S. Supreme Court, for the first time in American history, ruled that a regulation on guns went too far. They had never done that before. Prior to that, the ruling, the most recent ruling was one from 1933, which said specifically that only the right to a militia is guaranteed, and that was in a law banning automatic weapons.
Well,
so,
please
forgive
my ignorance, but when I first learned about the Constitution, I read it to say that at the time the Founding Fathers didn't even believe in a standing army, right?
That's correct.
So they needed to have a militia, and consequently they wanted the militia to defend the country and fight the Indians and whatnot.
That's correct.
And so they were allowed to bear arms. But now that we have the largest standing army on the planet, does that still apply?
Well, that's the question that people raise. And the way you framed it is certainly what those who were against the Heller decision, the way they framed it. It was a very close decision. And as I said, it's the first time the Supreme Court has ruled on it, and it happened just last year. So they were asking Sotomayor questions because now that the Supreme Court has finally made itself clear on the Second Amendment after more than 200 years, they want to know how far she'd go. And I don't think the NRA got the answer they wanted, and I don't think those that oppose Heller got the answer they wanted either. She's going to apply existing precedent, as she said she would, but it's subject to the doctrine of stare decisis and everything else. So, in other words, it, like anything else, can be overturned.
So is this new ruling for individual rights, would that explain that now we learn that people can carry guns to churches and,
well,
to bars?
I think, actually, the Heller decision opened up far more questions than it answered. All it really said...
No, but they said, I read it, that from now on you can take a gun to a bar, which, you know... is
those are state legal questions.
I see.
Those are all state law questions. In my home state of Tennessee, that's exactly what they were debating, whether or not they could take a gun to a bar. Heller doesn't open this up. These are state regulations to decide. All that Heller says is that sometimes a state can go too far in regulating guns. They said the District of Columbia went too far and restricted people's right to own guns too much. But no one knows whether a less severe restriction would violate the Constitution. The only time any state regulation on guns has ever been struck down was this time last year, D.C.'s decision. So all these other questions about bars and churches, that's all to be fought in individual states. And only if a restriction is too severe will the Supreme Court strike it down.
I see. All right. We have time for one more call, and I see we have a call from Paul in Pensacola. Good afternoon, Paul. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Hello, Sasha. The other day, my brother was telling me some really strange story, and I think you have the same guy on, Mark Levin, a Levine, he said.
Are you the strange guy, Mark?
Well, it depends on which story. You're talking about the FBI cover-up or something else?
All right.
Yeah. No, that was it. He said, well, I didn't know it was a cover-up. He said it was like the FBI didn't care or something, that Muslims and skinheads are getting together to kill Jews or something. And it just sounded so bizarre.
That's true. And you can find the article on alternet.org or on my website, radioinsidescoop.com. And again, the article is interesting. It doesn't say the FBI is racist or anti-Semitic or anything like that, but that the FBI was more concerned about protecting their illegal methods of surveillance than they were about actually going after terrorists. And as I said, this isn't some crazy conspiracy theory. It's been confirmed by no less than a very moderate conservative Republican, Chuck Grassley, as well as Agent
German.
My
gosh. Well, Paul, you must be extremely knowledgeable about this.
All right. No.
But I really appreciate your call. We are running out of time here, and if you have a chance, listen to his response on your internet or your radio. Thank you, Paul. Well, here is another person from Pensacola. Mark?
Yes. Well, I'm glad that people are reading the article. I'm sorry we didn't have more time. Paul, if you want more information, you can find it on my website, and I'll be happy to talk with you in more detail there. We're just out of time, I guess.
Well, not exactly yet, but I wanted to be able to finish. You may want to give out your email address, too, if
Certainly.
People wanted to write to you.
Absolutely. It's Mark, M-A-R-K, at radioinsidescoop.com. And that's my website, radioinsidescoop.com. If you forget it, you can just go to marklevineradio.com. It'll take you to the same place.
Well, and, you can be Googled and all sorts of good things will
exactly.
come up, including your pictures. All right. Now, Mark, you really vetted our appetite hearing your knowledgeable responses, etc. So we have to sort of regroup and do this some more.
I would love to.
What other things would you like to... illuminate us all.
Oh, I can talk about anything, Sasha. You know that.
I know
whether
that.
Whether it's domestic policy, foreign policy, or particularly the law. I always like talking about the law.
Well, that's it. By the way, I should really explain something about Mark. He is not just a smart attorney. I don't have my exact papers in front of me, but you also have you are an economist from. Yale or vice versa?
I have an economics degree from Harvard. It's my law degree that's from Yale.
Yes.
So I went to the same law school as, I think Judge Sotomayor went to Yale. I need to check that. I don't want to say that unless I know it to be true.
Well, not only that, but I'm sorry. The last time we talked, we discovered that you went to the same law school as Attorney Yu.
Yeah, it's true, actually. John Yu, the author of the torture memos, was a classmate of mine. And he and I used to have disagreements way back when in law school. Who knew what he would grow up to do?
So you knew you.
I knew you when.
Now,
and I'm sorry to say that I strongly disagree with him then. I didn't think he had showed much respect for the law at that time, and I still don't think he does, honestly.
Now, in closing, let me pick your brain. What do you hear from your listeners? What's the buzz in Washington? What do they want to talk about and ask you about?
I think the buzz is healthcare. This is the thing that's around the corner. This is the thing that a lot of people are happy about and concerned about. I don't think anyone's read the 1,000-page bill, and yet all of us recognize that something has to be done. And there's a lot of discussion on whether or not there should be a public option, whether how this affects ordinary people's lives. I think that's the next big issue, and it's something that people are really going to be looking closely over the next few weeks.
Well, in Washington, aren't most people already insured and probably on sort of like a government insurance?
If you work for the government, you certainly are insured. A lot of the people who oppose a public option get a public option themselves. That's certainly true.
I see. And what basically is the feeling about what do you think it will happen? Will it pass? Or
I think it will pass. I think it's going to be very difficult. Harry Truman famously tried and failed. Hillary Clinton famously tried and failed.
Yes.
But at this point, with healthcare being 16% of our gross domestic product, I think people recognize that something has to be done. I don't know what's going to happen, but I believe that some manner of health reform will pass and will pass this year.
But is it good enough if just some manner passes? In other words, if it's not effective enough, it will fail.
I suppose the devil's in the details, and we don't know them yet, Sasha.
All right. Well, Mark Levine, I'm delighted that you spent time with us, and I hope we can do this again soon and get some news from the Inside Scoop in Washington.
Thank you again, Sasha.
Thank you. We have come to the end of the program today. I thank my guest, Mark Levine, host of the Inside Scoop Talk Radio. My producers were Richard Chinquin and Mike Canary. Please tune in next Friday at noon for another timely conversation. And remember that you can hear the program live or archived on the internet at wgcu.org/Sasha. You can write me at Sasha Show, that's S-A-S-H-A, at comcast.net. And if you wish to add a question or comment about the program, you can call our 24/7 feedback line 877-GCU-TALK and record your thoughts on the voicemail. And now please stay tuned for BBC's Word Have Your Say coming up next. Thank you for listening and have a safe and wonderful weekend.